Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers and electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit the play button on your iPod, iPad, computer, Surface, whatever device you're listening to. This show is a special show for me because back in, it dates back to 2005. Frankly, I was bored at the time. I had just sold my legal staffing company to special counsel. I probably shouldn't say it this way, but, I think statute of limitations has run out. And due to their corporate structure at the time, I could only sell to contacts I made in Pittsburgh, which is what I've been doing for 10, 15 years. So since I'd helped to design the largest document review project in the country at that time, I decided to start attending the national e-discovery conferences just to do something different. And these were all sprouting up at the time, post-Zuba Lake. And that's where I met this group and about 50 other people around the country who helped to provide tips for what turned into Discovery Land, which is a board game on e-discovery. And it was all based on my suggestion that, hey, why don't we build this board game? So as a staffing person, I was literally at the only staffing person attending these conferences in the field at that time, and I firmly occupied the 4 p.m. speaking slot on the last day of most of the conferences I attended. Anyone that's spoken at a conference knows that no one's there at that point. But so really, to summarize, everyone viewed me as a nice guy who didn't threaten their business model. So everyone spoke to me, and I was speaking to everyone I could. So I focused my questions on building this game on sort of a defect analysis and would just ask people what problems they saw at various stages of the e-discovery process. And, it wasn't a total Six Sigma project, but at the end of the process, we had a nice set of issues that occur on many projects, as well as some best practice tips from frankly, some of the thought leaders in the field. I then picked four guests on this show who happened to be the money for the game back in 2005, because at that time I saw them as market leaders based on the things they were saying at conferences, their positions, and their track records. And I decided to do this as sort of a holiday or post-holiday show because these are four of my friends, and we go back a long way, and I thought this would be a lot of fun to do. So we're going to revisit the issues we had in the game and update where we are as a group and where we see Discovery heading today in 2014. So let's do the introductions a different way. Let's start off look back to 2005 when we when we designed Discovery Land, and what were each of you doing at the time? So the first guest is Kevin Esposito, the Million Dollar Bill. What was going on in your life?
Well, at that point in time, I was working for Pfizer, and I had been recruited from UPS, where I had spent many years in IT hardware and software development before becoming their first dedicated IT attorney. Pfizer was well aware that IT and records management had a significant impact on litigation costs and asked me to assist in revamping both their e-discovery and their records management practices. We assembled what became known as the Discovery Response Team and drove a complete refresh of their record retention schedule and their records management processes. Part of my job included appearing on the speaking circuit, and that's, how you and I met. And I was out there as a typical legal services purchaser telling other corporations about the issues that we faced and how we used a combination of people, process, and technology to meet those issues. My speaking slots tend to be a little earlier in the morning, like 9 a.m. on the first day. It's just like in the movie Tron. Lots of people wanted to see what a real live user looked like. So it was an interesting process.
And Kevin, was I not the only vendor in the country that never tried to sell you anything?
Absolutely.
Anyway,
I had a huge Rolodex and still do, and it was from all the people that came through the door telling me that they could do everything for me, anything I ever needed for a song.
All right. Well, Jim Mikowitz was the $500,000 bill, and Jim, what were you up to at that time?
Well, I was really trying to figure out how I could become the $1 million and knock Kevin off was what I was really doing at the time. But other than that, I was working for Tyco International in Princeton, New Jersey. And I was in a newly created position called Litigation Program Manager, which included developing an internal, across these business segments, litigation practice group, and to match it with external providers, including law firms, to the support of our different litigation portfolios. throw in there the role of discovery manager, and I also think records manager, and I was a Six Sigma champion of legal. So for me, when I think about eDiscovery and ESI at the time, we were in the process of responding to one of the largest shareholder lawsuits that we know of mankind. And in terms of being able to go ahead and really develop a discovery management process for Tyco and looking at full life cycle kind of management, that's really what we were attending to. So also around that time period was when I testified in front of the Rules Committee in terms of changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure relative to e-discovery.
And Jim, as I recall, I did actually try to assist in selling you something at that time. So I did step outside of Pittsburgh, but anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway, Jim Daly was the $100,000 bill. And Jim, you know, what were you doing at the time?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that Jim Michalowicz was heavily overvalued. It was strategic. We were trying to get his business at the time. And of course, Kevin was worth every penny, I think. So, but at the time, I was just finishing up a 10-year stint as head of the and founder of the Technology Law and eDiscovery Group at Shokardian Bank, an international Am Law 100 law firm. And we had the... We certainly had the blessing of being involved in the front lines of the e-discovery wars that began in about 1995. So from 1995 on, I had the benefit of using litigation and technology background to develop a team to try to get ahead of the curve on some of these issues. And certainly myself, Jim Michalowicz, many others had already become involved in the Sedona Conference group dealing with electronic records retention, developed some principles and kind of a code of conduct that all could agree with in terms of dealing with these issues.
And Jim also created the Zen of Zubelake, which were the three C's, communicate, coordinate, comply, and I added the fourth C of Cabernet, which started the whole wine thing. So a little side story there. And last on the list is Tim Opsitnik, who is the $50,000 bill. Tim, what were you up to at the time?
Well, first of all, I've never forgiven you for being the $50,000 bill, but I've always been slow and steady, and I continue to be slow and steady. At that time, I was 5 years from my practice at Jones Day that I'd left. I started our company, Journov, in 2000, and we focused on e-discovery consulting and litigation management systems, hosting data for litigation documents to be reviewed and collecting data and computer forensics. And, you know, was taking a leadership position in with some of the groups that were trying to develop good business practices at Sedona and the Georgetown Law Center's CLE. So was basically hot and heavy in the e-discovery area and had been for about 5 years at that point.
And at that point in time, I, of course, had sold my company, Legal Network, to Special Counsel, and you know, this was early on where I was trying to figure out what I was doing there, and I sort of created a role of e-discovery guru based on the game and a lot of the articles that I was writing and some of the webinars that I put together at what's turned now into, I think, Bloomberg's webinar process. You know, eventually they did create a role for me to travel the country and try to sell in other markets. And, you know, it was an interesting time trying to figure out how staffing fit into the puzzle there, because at the time I could tell how expensive it was, but no one was really looking at it. So, so Tim, obviously you're the most stable of all of us, since you're the only one who's still back where you, who's still where you are. So that's truly remarkable in the field of e-discovery. But we'll address that at the end of the game. Now let's start with the board game, the show. We started out with a first phase in the game called planning. And Jim Daly and Jim Michalowicz, I know you're both big on planning. So, Jim, what were we thinking about back then? What risks were on the table?
Yeah, I think the risks a lot had to do with the bad days come if you do something dumb. And Some could be delete documents, destroy backup dates, et cetera, like this. And this is when we start seeing a lot of the big sanction cases. So I think very much reactive mode, Carl, was how I'd kind of call the theme of that time period. So going back to what I was saying earlier about where I was at the time with Tyco, you know, I sometimes like to say that with e-discovery, it's kind of really like a life cycle. There's life-changing events to that life cycle of information management. And a life-changing event could be like a government investigation, and that's exactly what we were faced with there at Tyco. So I feel that in terms of planning is to kind of say how to move from reactive to responsive and to look at that full life cycle and to really see how can you go make it so that you've got a system, a process that can really go ahead and for the most part defend these type of cases and move it, let's say, from reactive to responsive. Like going back to 2005, I think from a planning stage it was much more of a reactive, especially to the big sanction cases that were starting to come out.
Okay, Jim, let's play the game. Discovery Land Card says, planning stage, technology bites you. The record retention policy which is drafted is not saved in an accessible location. As a result, it's impossible to implement the policy throughout your company. Your total cost, 9 Tim Upsetniks, $450,000. So what we were saying back then to fix this problem, what were we saying, and how has it changed today?
Yeah, this is Jim Daly, and I agree with what Jim Michalowicz said. I think at that time we were just beginning to think of the information management lifecycle as the root of the problem, with e-discovery being kind of a symptom of improper, inadequate records management, information management programs. And so I would say, you know, at that time in 2005, there were still a lot of companies, a large number of companies that didn't even have a records management policy. And if they had one, it wasn't communicated very effectively or efficiently. A lot of companies got in trouble in terms of litigation where their top executives didn't even know that a records management policy existed, and they were sanctioned quite heavily as a result. So at that time, I think we were just beginning to, and with many of our clients, all of us, to talk to them about records management as a foundation of good information management, and really the only way forward to stem the tide of proliferation of a lot of electronic and non-electronic information that didn't need to be kept for business or legal reasons. Of course, that happens. There's a whole downstream explosion of time and cost and risk associated with having to deal with all that information. Now, that challenge continues today, but I think there's been a lot more focus on it after 2005 to the present.
So, Tim, we didn't have all pain in the game. We had best practice tips, too. And here's one from Jim Daly in the planning stage that you can comment on. Best practice tips, Jim Daly, Esquire, by integrating technology around legal requirements of the project on a proactive basis enables the technical requirements of the project to be more easily identified, reducing costs and duplication of effort. You save $200,000 in project costs. You know, what was Jim thinking there?
Well, I think Jim was thinking all the right things and all the right pieces. I don't think they've changed to this day. You surround yourself by smart people, by technology that works. And the third part of the puzzle is a good workflow or a process. And, you know, what Jim is saying here is, you know, go out there, develop the policy and the statement that works for you and find the right technology. And, of course, it's you've got the right people implementing it. I don't think that's changed today. That's where we are today. There's certainly different and new technologies. There's new types of documents and information which has caused changes to workflow, things like social media and the like. But generally speaking, the three most important things, people, process, and technology, have stayed the same.
Sounds like I got to come up with a new alcohol based on that one there. So anyway, let's think about planning today. And Kevin, where's planning going today?
Well, I'm tempted to say down the tubes, but I don't want to be that cynical this early in a new year. In graduate business school, it's always drilled into you that all organizations have this very defined process for setting out a plan and working the plan and doing things like that. And then you get into, actual corporations and find out that's a lot of hokum. Planning still appears to be a lost art. Many of the clients that call us in are caught in the ready, fire, aim syndrome, all the time. A lot of this is due to time pressures, and for the largest corporations, it's because of the, the short-term nature of business, everybody looking to the next quarter's results. And it's an old adage that if you don't find the time to do something right the first time, you're going to have to find the time to redo it a second time. A lot of organizations seem to be so focused on being seen to do something that they don't spend the appropriate amount of time on planning and preparation prior to action. Consequently, we spend a lot of our time on our side either developing plans for them or managing the process of planning the work that eventually needs to be done. So, I think a lot of organizations are still caught in a bind. They're trying to get stuff done or to be seen to get stuff done, and no one really wants to take the time to plan out the work prior to doing it. That's an expense that they're not willing to, engage in. But then they have to, work with people like us because they put a foot wrong and they've forgotten something, and they wind up with a problem. So it's kind of a false savings, but I wish they would invest a lot more in planning than they currently are.
Well, the variable that stayed consistent is human nature here. So maybe that's a big part of it until technology can help solve the problem more than it does.
No, I don't think that technology is necessarily, the solution. Technology isn't the solution to everything. There are still people involved. There are still people who work for corporations. And whether it's a large corporation or a small business, it's the people. It's the people who get things done. There's never going to be a robot or a special widget that's going to get this done for people. And I think it's a mistake for them to think that technology is going to be their savior because, again, that's the quick pill. They just want to take that and everything's taken care of. They need to understand that this is hard work and it's part of running a business.
I guess I'm thinking on the reactive mode, which is where I also tend to get in a lot of the time, that, cool technology, newer technology, and smaller groups of people can remove a lot of pain. But that's not the question here. Let's go to the next. I'll go into the next phase here, which in Discovery Land was collection and preservation. And let's focus these questions to Tim Opsitnik, since I know you work in that area. So collection and preservation never gets the credit it deserves, and Tim, you're the lowest cost denomination in the game, so let's start by asking you these questions. Tim, is collection and preservation the lowest cost area?
Well, I think it is. I can collect a whole lot of data in a very short period of time compared to what it takes to actually review and or process that downstream. So it is a very small cost area in the e-discovery circle.
Okay. And let's turn to the game now. So, Tim, what were we thinking back in 2005? What were the risks that were on the table in this phase?
Well, I think the risks that were on the table were there was a lot being said about the loss of backup tapes, failure to find backup tapes. Morgan Stanley was out there, and there were all sorts of concerns about companies, how to keep data and how to produce the right amount of data and how to find it. And those were the overwhelming themes at the time. And I don't think that's changed a whole lot. I think today our risks are failure to preserve and failure to produce. So from that perspective, I really don't think the risks have changed much. That's what the current discussion on amendments to the federal rules are trying to focus on, are sanctions and other things for failure to preserve and produce. And so I think we're in the same place we were back then on collection and preservation.
So Jim Michaelowitz, give you the question from Discovery Land. The card we've pulled says, technology bites you. The litigation hold notices were not sent to enough potential custodians of relevant, potentially relevant information and did not provide enough guidance that the request pertains to electronic files on laptops, PDAs, removable storage devices, voicemail, instant messaging, and other electronic media. Total cost $500,000. What were we saying back then to answer this problem, and how has it changed today?
Could we pull another card? I didn't like that one. So here's the thing. It's kind of interesting, Carl, because we jumped from, you know, planning right into collection and preservation. And before the term EDRM was in vogue, a number of us on this call had our own, I guess, little workflow analysis tools that we use. So I think what's really interesting about this is that there was really no steps in there that was for define and identify. And define meaning the scope of the request and therefore the response. And scope could include both the types of custodians, but also the types of ESI. So going back to what we were saying before, that, you know, reactive mode. So, wow, here's what's being named in the request, anything that's called electronic. And let's go ahead, and anything that's electronic, we better go ahead and see what we can grab, even though we don't know if this stuff is really responsive or not. And I think, you know, when we start talking about PDAs and so forth like this and voicemail, it's like, nah, I'm not too sure if it's really accessible. So that's one of the things, obviously, that has changed, is to put that type of reasonably accessible into the actual guidelines themselves. So a couple things here. I think one is, there really wasn't, getting back to our workflow and our process steps, anything that was built in there that said define and also to identify before you go ahead and collect and preserve. Again, reactive mode. Hopefully we're moving a little more to proactive and responsive mode.
Okay, we also have the human side in the game. And Kevin, I'll give you a question in this area from the game. Kevin, you've been blogged. You attempted to dictate in legalese and technical jargon the requirements of the collection and preservation notices to your company. As a result, the request is not embraced by some of the company employees, and documents fall through the cracks, and some employees delete emails. Total cost for a poorly implemented collection effort, $500,000, and serious risks for sanctions. How are we doing today with communication risks, and do we get a mini Tony Soprano story here?
Well, you know, I think it's a little unique, Carl. You're one of the few people that use my name and the term human in the same sentence there. But no, you know, Tony's gone, unfortunately. He had his day, although the lessons that were learned are still applicable. I think the reason that people like my Sopranos routine so much wasn't really because I was from Jersey and I thought that was such a great kind of, you know, connection there, but it was because it did just the opposite of the scenario in your question. Rather than get caught up in either legalese or techie speak, the mob guys break things down into very basic issues. Who or what is the risk? How do we eliminate that risk? And how do we make sure it doesn't embarrass us or worse in the future? You know, I still use pop culture references to assist my clients in breaking down communications barriers because, you know, the barriers between business people, technology people, and lawyers still exist, and they probably always will. Those three groups aren't unique in the fact that they have their own language or that they have their own way of handling information. You know, we see the same sort of issues with clients of ours that are doctors, accountants, educators, and it happens in a lot of areas. Breaking down barriers will always be a challenge for people, but once you do address that challenge, it makes other parts of the process easier to deal with. I think a lot of the things that have happened since the recession of 08 to 2010 is that people are kind of reaching their breaking point, and they're really saying, just talk to me. You know, don't paint things up in some special verbiage. Don't try to impress me with how smart you are. I've got a problem. How do I fix it? And where do we go from here? And I think if people can learn to talk to each other that way, it makes everybody's job a lot easier.
Yeah, I agree. Communication is sometimes the hardest thing to do when everyone's moving quickly. Well, let's move into the next phase of the game, and that was called indexing and searching. And Jim Daly, what were we thinking about back then?
I think we were thinking back then that one of the first problems we had is we didn't know as businesses, or our clients didn't know what they had in terms of information, and they didn't know how to find it. I think Gartner and other groups have identified that as one of the biggest areas of risk in terms of governance. And if you think of information as being an information governance problem, it's pretty clear that the only way forward, the only way to avoid significant e-discovery costs and risks and compliance costs and risks is really to know yourself, to understand where your information is, whether it's privacy-related information, strategic information, information assets, intellectual property, and thereby know how you can cull the wheat from the chaff. How can you begin to separate out what you do need to keep for business and legal reasons from that which you do not? So I think we're thinking, really starting to think in terms of what I call the IPO model, input, process, output, realizing that you can't find things unless you can search for them. You can't search for them unless, if electronically, they are indexed and there's a way to search for them. So we're beginning to look more closely at technologies to help solve what is essentially a technology problem, the proliferation of electronic information, particularly unstructured electronic information, email and Microsoft Office documents without any kind of organizational framework.
So, Tim, the Discovery Land card I pulled says, technology bites you. You hired multiple technology vendors to identify documents across the many geographic locations of your client. Then the data has not been captured, that has been captured, has not been captured in a uniform format, resulting in a poorly constructed database. This mess creates a database which must be cleaned up by hand. The excess cost is $500,000. What were we saying back then to answer this problem, and is it still real today, or has it changed?
I don't think that the scope of the problem is as great today as it was back then. I think as a result of efforts like the Sedona group that focuses on issues with the vendors and EDRM, there have been a lot of good business practices developed and workflows and particular models to follow in collecting and preserving data. So as a result, generally you don't see these problems as much, although when they do happen, they tend to be perhaps even bigger at times. Now, where we begin to see the problems are new data types that evolve. For example, social media. You know, what do we do about reviewing of social media? So for the data types that existed back then, we've developed good ideas moving forward with the advent of new types of data and things that, you know, we've had to develop new processes. But the problem is still not as bad today as it was back 8 years ago when we spoke about this.
Good, we're making progress. So Jim Mikowitz, let's talk about some additional progress areas. How has the field of searching and indexing data itself changed?
Before I ask that question, Carl, I just want to see, what does the game board look like right now? I think I've got like two data centers on one of my spots right now and a law firm, and just want to see, am I winning right now or not?
You know, we've only played the game three times, so...
Yeah, all I care is I just want to make sure I beat Kevin Esposito. That's really my goal in this whole thing.
I'll decide at the end.
Yeah, okay. So, interesting, as far as this, you know, the question as far as the use of search and indexing tools, I guess two responses. Those are probably not the ones we're expecting. One is messaging and acceptance. So if you look back then, I had my conspiracy theories and said that a lot of the reason why there wasn't really full acceptance or even penetration of these different tools that seemed to bring some efficiency and some cost savings to it was that those who have been doing historically were saying, you're taking money out of our pockets here, so don't be doing that. So I think part of the messaging was that the use of these tools was, you know, computers replacing attorneys. And in some ways, shame on those providers that were kind of messaging that way. But then also, I think those who were part of the conspiracy were kind of saying, yeah, you know what, we need to do a little bit of protection here as far as our revenue, and these tools really are not good. So that's what I think number one is the messaging. And I think what we're also seeing is, it's been slow, but acceptance of these different tools. And now that everyone was waiting on the sidelines for judges to make some decisions relative to the efficacy of these tools, and now that's starting to happen. So that, to me, I think are the biggest changes without getting into the weeds as far as how the technology itself and the different components of it have changed. But I think messaging and acceptance.
Hey, Jim, do you think that that's primarily because these tools really are being accepted that much, or do you think it's because overall the dollars have dried up and people are being forced to be a little bit more accepting because, you know, the people on the conspiracy side, their clients are saying, you know, you're too expensive for me, I can't afford you anymore. And the people who are, you know, pushing tools are saying, you know, well, in the same token, you can spend it with me, you can spend it somewhere else.
Yeah, good question. So I think it will bounce those because I think there is more sophistication as far as the buyers. I'm calling the buyers the Office of the General Counsel. And that they really now are seeing that, you know, this is a bunch of hogwash as far as saying, oh, you can't do this, you can't do this. And they're looking for the law firms to take some element of risk, and but also to protect them in case any questions come up. So it's kind of a dual blade there. So I think a lot of it is sophistication, understanding now of the buyers, a little bit more push towards using these. In fact, even including this in maybe the outside counsel guidelines, that in terms of even negotiating search terms and the use of tools, that that's now built into the process. So I think there's that. I think the other thing, Kevin, is frankly wins. You know, just to show that there are some wins here. And, you know, it goes back to that a company did use it in litigation, and guess what? The world didn't end. It actually worked out well, and there was success of that.
So, Kevin, here's one of Tim's best practice tips, and you can comment on it. You evaluated the cost of renting software versus buying it as an application for your project and whether you have the in-house staff to run and maintain the software. This enabled you to make a cost-effective decision on the IT infrastructure of the project. Because you elected to buy the software, you were able to maintain performance at a high level throughout the course of the project and save $300,000 in the project. Is this trend still out here today, and what challenges are we seeing?
I don't think it's necessarily there. One of the things we used to joke about in 2005, you know, when we were together on a speaking circuit, was we used to make reference to the movie The Right Stuff and point out that, you know, if there's no bucks, there's no Buck Rogers. And during the economic downturn over the past few years, we've actually seen fewer and fewer companies willing to take on the care and feeding of a new system. I've noticed that GCs and CIOs tend to move in packs. So there was a period of time where GCs and CIOs were banding together. They were buying stuff. And then the one thing they really like to do is to go to conferences or to go to meetings with other GCs and CIOs and say, hey, look what we did, and you haven't done it. And part of it, I think, is an attempt to validate what they've done, and part of it is trying to make sure that they're one step ahead of their competition or even their friends and compatriots. So we still assist people with the cost-benefit analysis, but my personal experience is that they're less worried about the purchase price of an application, and they're more concerned about the ongoing cost of adding headcount. And the whole Obamacare or, let's just say, healthcare system issues that we're dealing with right now makes that even bigger. Because in the past, people used to say, oh, well, you know, so many dollars for a person and so many dollars for benefits. Now they're really looking less at salary and more at that benefits picture and thinking, I don't want to saddle my organization with a lot more people to support this particular application, especially for something that's in a very tight niche like legal services. You know, there's a lot of products out there for use in-house if the client has enough litigation footprint to make it worthwhile for the investment in both manpower and the actual purchase. But for companies that aren't serial litigants, they're probably going to continue to either outsource or rent by the event.
Okay, well, let's look at staffing and war room. Tim, you got the questions in front of you?
I'm ready to go, Carl. It's unfair for you to ask the questions, so I get to ask the questions on this area. So, Carl, why was staffing in War Room the longest section of the game, and not because you made the game, Carl?
Well, you know, I was working at the time for a company paying me a salary, and I had to build into the game some of the things that we actually did. So, I made it the longest part of the game because at that time I saw so many parts of the game that I didn't have a handle on. And so, you know, rather than have a part of a game that was a small part and then go into the next section, you know, I wanted to be able to contribute something. So that's the honest answer. But I also think that the part of the issue was I was trying to draw attention to the fact that, you know, we don't think about review much at that time. It was just put some butts in seats and let's start reviewing. So anyway, that's it.
So what were you thinking back then? What were the risks and concerns back then that drove, you know, your part of the deck?
Well, you know, at that time, I mean, once we began looking at the volume of ESI, you know, I think as everyone said at the beginning, Jim and both Jims in particular, we weren't really planning much. You know, once cases began hitting, it got awfully expensive very quickly, especially when you were using law firm associates to do the review. You know, at that time, we'd just gone through a boom period. I remember salaries were hitting the $100,000 range, and I remember articles about judges saying, hey, they're making more than us now. This is unbelievable, and these are new lawyers. And so the easiest solution at the time was to lower the cost of review. And that was the advent of the contract attorney. And at that time, contract attorneys were primarily in major markets. And what I focused on was bringing it into the Midwest, into second, you know, tier mid-range markets like Pittsburgh, Cleveland. And, you know, the goal was to keep reducing the costs even further, but also to provide stability of not jumping around projects, which was seeming to happen at that time. Yeah, but the problem here was even though we were lowering the cost of the review to a lower hourly rate, the data amounts continued to grow exponentially, and technology solutions began to emerge to attack that. So the initial solution was to marry technology and review, and that turned into something we called managed review. So there was an evolution back then, and I think it came from thinking about, you know, what are all the problems that are here, and from a staffing perspective, the staffing companies, I think, wanted to try to combine with technology to offer a better solution.
Okay. Kevin, the Discoveryland card that's been selected says you've been blogged. You started the project without assigning a project manager to track the coding team's performance. A lack of cohesiveness is not lost on the team who feel adrift from the rest of the project. You lose $300,000 in productivity. I think I already know your answer to this question based on your prior response on planning, but do we still see project management issues in the staffing world?
Yes, certainly, Tim, we do. You know, you're right. As per what I said earlier, I think Carl mentioned an important word a couple minutes ago when he talked about stability. And, you know, everyone these days is searching for stability, whether it's a person or a corporation. And sometimes it's hard to provide that. And as people migrate towards opportunities that are going to provide them with more stability, sometimes they're not available for continued work the way that we work on a project-by-project or, you know, case-by-case basis. And you're right. I think this is related to what was asked earlier about planning. The project management element of matter management, you know, can really make or break a case. See it all the time. Planning and project management obviously go hand in hand, and we spend a large part of our time finding the appropriate people to assist with project management within a client's organization. It's kind of funny to me sometimes that the clients don't necessarily put their best person forward. They might have someone who's completely qualified and prepared to take on that particular sort of management area, but they may not realize it because they've got them seconded off to some other operation or some other task. And then sometimes the person that has been assigned doesn't have the requisite skills. and the person may not have enough internal clout to get decisions made or to, you know, just get the job done. So finding the right mix of people to manage a matter is just as critical as finding the latest software tool or review methodology. And, you know, it's, as I said earlier, it's not necessarily technology that's going to save you. It's people. And, you know, finding the right people and making sure that they're assigned to track this information is critical.
I'll take control of the show back now, Tim, but I'm going to also add that I thought that was a great answer. In addition to stability, they're also looking for quality and instead of just bodies and less bodies, not only because it reduces the cost, but it becomes easier to project manage when you have high quality and less people. So that's something that I would add into that. But you know, Jim, without stealing all your thunder there, Jim Daly, since I was going into how the review world's changed since 1995, anything that you're seeing right now that's indicating change?
Well, you know, Carl, I think it's been kind of like a 10-year cycle since 1995. The first 10 years, people struggling with trying to move from in law firm attorney review at a very high cost, and I think the costs of review have been estimated as high as 70 to 75% of all e-discovery costs, and that certainly was a big issue during the first decade. But through efforts of yours and others to try to develop a better review mousetrap and focusing on managed review, you know, focusing on how to increase efficiency and productivity without losing quality, both through the use of staffing, training, supervision, and beginning to use some technology to find things like clusters of similar documents or near duplicates and the like to increase the flow rate. It has really changed in the last decade, and I think. You know, 2015 onward is even more promising in terms of computer-assisted review, technology-assisted review. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. I do think that, you know, one thing to really emphasize here is whether we're talking about outsourcing to reviewers in India or the Philippines, you know, whether we're talking about using technology to assist in review, fundamentally, attorneys, general counsels, and outside counsel, they also have an ethical obligation. That ethical obligation under the professional rules of conduct to make sure that there is adequate supervision, training, follow-up oversight, and to ensure that, and I know Jim Michelwitz spoke to this as well as Kevin, that there is a repeatable process in place and that it's verifiable and it's demonstrable and it can really be communicated to a decision maker in those situations where you have to defend the process of how you reviewed your documents. So I think a lot of improvement since 1995, certainly, I think marginally, you know, in terms of comparative costs, a reduction in a commoditization of costs, a lot more competition driving down costs. So, you know, generally, I think the world is getting better in that regard.
So let's move in the next phase of discovery land, which is getting into the last third here, and it was called the midpoint. And in the game, this is when you were really learning what happened in the case after looking at some data. So Jim Michelwitz, what were we thinking about back then, and what's different?
I thought it was going to be Midway, and we're going to talk about the Battle of Midway. But okay, I'll be prepared to answer this question all the way. So, you know, it's interesting, Carl. So I know the term has been used, ECA, which really drives me bonkers because I look at early case assessment being much more of a big analytical process done by attorneys. And what has been captured by, I guess, those now by calling it ECA is really, in my mind, early data assessment. So be that as it may, I think if you look backwards, you know, E for e-discovery stood for endless. And it was kind of like an endless process to meet a production request. And I think what we're moving towards is E for evidentiary, and to be able to do some analysis of data as towards the facts of the case. So I think it's a slow migration, but back then I go with E, endless, and really this midway point was how are we doing in terms of responding to the production requests, and not as much as how do we use this data to support the facts of the case and for case strategy.
So, Tim, the Discovery Land says, best practice tips from Jim Mikowitz. You were now at Altman Weil when you wrote this one. but by taking the time to set performance standards and monitoring them, you are able to know what review rate is appropriate, what variance should be tolerated, how does the variance affect budgetary estimates, what period of time is appropriate for the monitoring cycle. Tracking these metrics makes the project run more smoothly with higher quality output and results in savings of $400,000. Can you tell this is one of Jim's points just from the verbiage in it, and is that point valid today and being done today?
Well, I don't have a Six Sigma black belt like Jim, but most of this stuff seems to me pretty much common sense, but it has evolved even more so over time, and it's even more important. You know, metrics have become critical in all sorts of review engagements. We've developed even different measurements, and companies have built the measurement directly into the tools, and it's become even more important than it was back then. I think we may be measuring different things today than what Jim was talking about when he developed these cards back then, but his point as to metrics has even evolved greatly, and there's more emphasis on it today.
Okay, Kevin Esposito, the pipeline management for data,
right,
is a team effort shared between the contract attorneys, the managers of the review team, to the IT company processing the data. A dashboard system has been created to let managers know where workflow currently stands. Given the case is a rolling production, there will be ebbs and flows. But by having the collecting team, the harvesting team, and the review team talking to each other, workflow is managed more efficiently. As a result, morale on the team is very good because work is being allocated fairly. Cost savings, $300,000. Kevin, what were we saying back then to answer this problem, and how has it changed today?
Well, you know, I think what we were saying back then is exactly what we're saying today. Seems like I'm getting all the planning and organization questions, but I do a CLE here in Northeast about everything I ever needed to know about business I learned at UPS. And, you know, that's pretty well true. And one of the biggest things I learned at UPS was measurement and management. UPS has a culture steeped in industrial engineering, and they study absolutely every single work process. And I've kind of transplanted that over to the legal profession. And so we've been analyzing all the processes that are involved as well. And what you were saying back then about putting together dashboards is something that, you know, we constantly have to do with clients today. It's amazing to me sometimes that there's no one that's tracking where information is coming from, where it's going, who has it, how much of it has been, you know, taken care of. You know, the game mentions that the dashboard system is a way of nudging people in the best practice direction. Most companies don't have anything like this. I mean, they didn't have it at that time, and a lot of companies don't have it even today. You know, we had put in a dashboard at Pfizer, and it provided a lot of great management tools for us, but most of my clients still don't have a dashboard of their own. Some of them do rely on dashboards that are provided in products, and that's a good thing. That's something I always encourage them to do. You know, we go in and insist on having a way of tracking information, and that goes a lot, you know, goes a long way towards addressing the planning and project management issues. So you know where your inputs are, you know where your outputs are. A lot of the businesses understand inputs and outputs because they use it to do manufacturing every day. So it gets buy-in from a lot of people. And, you know, it's important to know that you don't necessarily need to have an application or real-time tracking system, just as long as you've got some way of finding out where information is and monitoring it through the process. We've done very low-tech dashboards with daily reports that are put out, you know, by fax machines, and, you know, we've gone all the way to more sophisticated locations with websites where people are logging in and checking things out. that, you know, the basic issue then and now is that you've got to control the flow of information, and you need to be sure that everyone has one source of tracking information to be consistent and safe. You don't want people looking at information that's old, or you don't want people looking at it and thinking, oh, I thought that custodian was done, but it's really still in process, or it's still really still in collection. Everyone's got to have the same information, and that information's got to be, you know, available to all members of the team.
Okay. Actually, the next question, Jim Michaels, I thought you did such a good job with your midway answer that you, I think you answered that. So we're going to go into the final section of the game here. And I'm going to give this to Jim Daly. It's a section which only the lawyers could play called Motions Court. And Jim Daly, what were we thinking about back then, and what were the typical fights over?
Well, if I could take a moment to echo what Kevin said, and frankly, it's kind of the message that I first heard from Jim Michaelwitz during the very first Sedona Working Group 1 session we had October 17, 2002, and actually in Sedona, Arizona, one of the few times we actually met in Sedona, Arizona. But that is, process is really the thing. And you've got to be able to defend your process. You know, I think it was Peter Drucker who echoed or said first, I think, what Kevin was echoing, and that is you can't manage what you can't measure. And likewise, you can't defend. You know, you can't defend without being able to demonstrate it and demonstrate it in a repeatable way. So what we're really fighting about from the very first days on is, did we have a repeatable, demonstrable, systematic process, content neutral, for communicating, coordinating, and at least measuring compliance? Three C's, or what I call the Zen of Zubalek, that Carl Yu expanded so bravely into including Cabernet as the fourth C, really important part of the equation and formula as well. So the defensive process was really behind what we call the motions to compel production and motions for sanctions for failure to comply with the orders from the court to produce certain electronic information. Those of us that have been deeply involved in litigation know that the discovery process in complex litigation can go on for years and years. And so it's very, very important to very quickly communicate to your knowledge workers, to your employees, what kind of information they need to preserve, particularly if it's unstructured information under their management and control. If you fail to do that, institutionally you can be found negligent and sometimes guilty of bad faith, reckless disregard, or sometimes trying to hide the ball. There are all manner of cases out there that really revolve around, has there been a process at all, starting with communication, and the vehicle of communication is a legal hold notice or litigation hold notice. Has there been any coordination with IT to make sure that there are proper enabling technologies and ways to avoid inadvertent destruction of relevant information, say when an employee leaves, and whether there's an offboarding process to make sure things under legal hold are still kept? And compliance monitoring in the sense of, you know, are we going to test whether our employees really have heard and understood what we're asking them to preserve and that they actually are applying the tools we've given them in a proper manner. So that's really where the battlegrounds have been drawn. And to the extent companies or organizations do a good job of communication, coordination, compliance, they've been pretty much, if not isolated from sanctions, they've certainly protect themselves against some of the catastrophic sanctions that some organizations and companies have had to deal with. It's a matter of, again, process orientation. We call it these days, I think, is the current term of art. And, you know, the Broccoli case, for instance, Broccoli versus Equistar, which is kind of a post-trial case in this regard, involves a situation where there wasn't any kind of notification sent to employees to save information. And the court found that that was, you know, an egregious failure leading to gross spoliation of evidence. In that case, it involved breach of contract and claims that there was some kind of harassment and retaliation claim. So even in your run-of-the-mill, you know, employment discrimination or retaliation case, these issues can arise and really test whether the company takes information governance by communicating, coordinating, and monitoring compliance.
Well, you also answered the question for the card there, which was Broccoli versus EchoStar. So that was very concise, and I think gets us to the end of the game, Jim. So I don't know, Kevin. You got any thoughts on this? You have the questions in front of you?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay.
You can tell this is a live show.
No, we took care of everything that was on that question. But I got a question for you. Wait a second. Let's get the important stuff. What about 4C? I mean, we talked about all these other things. We're at the end of the game, and when you're at the end of the game, you know, where do you go from there? What's happening with the 4C? Where are we with the use of wine in e-discovery projects?
I'm glad you asked that, because at the heart of it, I always thought this e-discovery, Discovery Land was a drinking game. So we ended up at 4C, and back then we were looking at the Zen of Zuba Lake, which were the three C's of communicate, coordinate, and comply, or get sanctioned. So I decided the 4C was Cabernet, because we had a hard time doing the first three. And at that time, Laura Zuba Lake and Judge Shinlin autographed the labels as a joking educational way to sort of drive home the message that we got to do a better job communicating. We're now in 2014, and at the end of 2013, I thought it was time for a new 4C. I thought about doing it in 2011, and I thought the 4C of collect Cabernet, you know, would be a nice drinking game and reflect what we were doing of over-collecting and just dying in data. But what we came up with in 2013 was a 4C of coordinate, cooperate, communicate, and share a Cabernet blend, you know, bringing in the cooperation themes. And Judge Grimm was kind enough to autograph that label. I actually have my own personal label with eight judges from around the country have autographed. It's my own cooperation proclamation. It ties into having a bottle of wine. So that's where we are with 4C. And I think that that sort of ties into the end of the game here pretty well. So thanks for asking. You know, what I really want to do at this point is sort of go into what we're doing now in 2013 and what we're seeing, sort of combining the last two questions, if you like. So, Kevin, what are you up to now in 2013 and 14, and what are you seeing?
Well, I mean, I guess really we're not doing anything different from the past 7 years, so I guess I'm stuck in a rut. I'm still the independent attorney/technologist working with my team to handle, you know, all of those project planning issues we talked about earlier and project management issues and that translation that needs to happen between people, techies, and lawyers. And, you know, we get to work on a lot of different types of matters with lots of different companies and law firms. So, you know, the work is always challenging and exciting. What we like to do, and I guess if we like what we do, anyone who can say that has a pretty good gig.
Good. And Jim Michowitz, how about yourself here in 2014? What are you up to, and what are you seeing as the big problems?
Sure. So I joined Huron Legal late last October, and in the law department consulting practice. And although e-discovery still has a special place in my heart, it's not really kind of focus of my practice. So prior to coming to Tyco, and then I stood it all the while, I had law department operations background, and so I'm kind of moving more onto that side. But I will say that as far as the discovery, there's a certain aspect of big data and also small data as part of my practice and the use of business analytics and the management of litigation.
So from that perspective, eDiscovery was a nice, I guess, launching pad to kind of like get deeper into how to get data and to make decisions, you know, data-driven decision-making processes. And so that's where my focus is. And as I say, I work with really Office of the General Counsel on cost management, risk management, outside counsel performance measurement, and the use of metrics.
Okay. And Jim Daly, how about yourself?
Well, in 2005, I left Shokardian Bacon and become involved in boutique law firms, co-founder of boutique law firms dealing with issues, e-discovery, domestic and international data privacy and security, and global, and also records management. So really what I've tried to do in kind of a small way is to practice what we preach in terms of a team approach, a multidisciplinary approach, dealing with some of these problems, to try to eventually get at the root cause of the problem, information governance. We can begin to get ahead of the curve and reduce the instances where we're talking about high e-discovery risk and cost or compliance risk and cost. So looking at it kind of as a seamless web or seamless garment, as all three of these things tend to converge upon. And as we've seen with the target situation recently, data privacy and breaches of data privacy and data security can have huge ramifications, not just for the company involved, but, you know, in that case, for hundreds of thousands or millions of customers worldwide. So our practice is really focused on, you know, how can we partner with organizations, companies, reduce legal risk and cost of e-discovery, data privacy, and records management. And particularly in a global market, there are all data protection laws complicate how you transfer and flow data or private data from country to the other.
So, Tim, what are you up to?
Well, I guess a lot like Kevin, I'm stuck in a rut here. We've been in business now for 14 years, still continuing to do e-discovery. I guess the areas I'd like to focus on in 2014 that I see as important is probably helping educate other lawyers to the good business practices that are being developed around the country and the world. And secondly, you know, adapting to evolving technology, which really has made great strides in the last few years to make things more economical in this area. And finally, I would say that a big focus of our company in the past 5 to 6 years has been the evolving area of cybersecurity, speaking of Target, which was raised by Jim Daly. We're doing more and more work on cybersecurity and helping companies defend themselves against data breaches and loss of data.
Okay, and I'd like to add that I actually took a stint where I worked with my good friend here, Tim Opsitnik, for a few years after doing staffing for a while, and it was great because Tim is such a fertile mind, and it was almost like a laboratory of trying to test out new ways to come up with solutions and deploy technology. What I ended up doing after that, because I'm an entrepreneur at heart, and, you know, it started my own business doing review consulting and consulted on global aerospace and have done a lot of predictive coding work, but I'm really focused rather substantially now on the review world through testing reviewers, and was pleased to see a case that I was working for the court system on just came out, the Garlock asbestos case. And I did the underlying review with a small team, like an all-star team of tested reviewers and some newer visual clustering tools. And, you know, it was a pretty amazing story. And You know, that's the type of thing that I enjoy doing, like everyone on this call, trying to find newer ways to do things more effectively with better controls. So you know, we're all evolving, which is good to hear, and all staying at the forefront of the field. So I'd like to end the show by thanking each of you, Kevin, Jim, and Tim, for joining us here at ASI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. It's especially gratifying when you get to do shows with your friends, like long-term friends like you guys are. I'd also like to thank Tim at Chernov for their continued support and hosting of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes for a complete list of the show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as ESI Bytes, or Easy Bytes. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day, and I hope everyone had a happy holiday.